Tommy D. Nixon. The son of the late Reverend W. N. Nixon and Susan A. Nixon. Who migrated to Montgomery somewhere in the late 90s, at that time. They had two boys and three girls. And after they arrived in Montgomery, I was born and became the third boy and the sixth child to this union. This happened on July the 12th, 1899. My father stayed in Montgomery, working at odds and end jobs. From what I can understand, trying to make ends meet to take care of a family of eight. Until I was approximately 5 years old. And during that time, he was called to preach. So I'm told. And he left Montgomery and went down in Autauga County, which was the home of my mother, where he started working on a farm, trying to earn a living for his family the best he could. At this time, he was living, at the time he left Montgomery, he was living in a house joining his sister, who was my auntie, and who named me. And of course, when he left, she prevailed with him to let her keep me, since she did not have any children. And my father then finally give in, and I lived with her until right after I passed my eighth birth. Of course, my father had came back from time to time see about me. My mother had came back also, but each time that my auntie prevailed with them to leave me with her, since she did not have any children. But on my daddy's last return before I left. He came back to Montgomery one summer. And he looked at me and he said to me, he said, boy, you big enough to plow. And of course I was a good sized boy for my age. And my daddy carried me to the country. I stayed down there until I was 14 in July. And I left October the 5th that same year. I did not like the country when I got there. And I liked it less when I left them. But during that time, my father, who had begun preaching, was home during the week, but away most all weekends. My mother, who had charge of the family and was doing a pretty good job trying to take care of all of us. Unfortunately, that I had the privilege to actually live with my mother about 5 years before she passed. And after that, my father was gone from time to time, serving as a minister, and finally came home a little less than a year after my mother's death, brought with him a new wife who was only a few years older than my older sister. It was hard for them to ever get along together since my sister had been living in the house all these years. And to bring a woman in the house unknown and put her over my sister, it just didn't work. So my sister put up with it as long as she could. And finally, she was married and moved out of the home. You probably would ask why that I did not like the country. Number one, the condition of homes in the country at that time was unbearable. The houses were run down, the floors was bad, and most time no ceiling in the house. And the house was heated with a large chimney and what was known as a fireplace. And I think the first assignment I got was to help my older brother cut up wood. Then there were the cows to be milked. There are horses and mules to be fed, chickens to be fed. And because of my size, along with other children, my dad expected me to come right in and take hold, or like the rest of the children had been doing. And it took me some time to catch on. But by the time that I was able to really learn about the farm and really catch hold to it showing up. I found that I really wasn't cut out for farming. Of course, I left. At the time that I left home, my stepmother and the rest of the children were there, and he was trying to gather the farm, and my father, he was out going on the path of the minister, and I just got fed up with it and packed my shirt and what else I had in a little bag, and I had a dollar, and a silver dollar, and I bought me a ticket, and I had 7 cents left when I got on the train. I came back to Montgomery. At that time, my auntie had married a man and moved out to Madison Park. And of course, I had never been to Madison Park, so I found a relative of mine lived on in the west part of Montgomery. And I went there, and they gave me a place to sleep. Sleeping in the kitchen with their boy. I talked to her husband to find out whether I could find a job somewhere, because I knew that I'd have to work to take care of myself. Wherever he was working at that time, he said that there was nobody needed. But the man next door, who was known to the family, said that I could go to work with him Monday morning. Of course, the water boy that they had all quit that weekend, and most likely that he would hire me as a water boy. So I went with him to work that morning. He worked on the streetcar line. And when the foreman saw me, when he had told him that he brought a boy out there to, if he could use him for a water boy, the foreman looked at me because of my size and everything. He said, "Hell, I ain't gonna hire him as a water boy. I'm gonna put him to work." And he put me out there to work with the men's. And I guess because of the long hours and hard work that I've done in the country, helped fitted me to make the 10 hours a day that I did on this back-breaking job, working on the streetcar track. And I stayed there, and the only joy that I got out of working for this company was they give all the employees a badge. You could pin that badge on and ride free without paying. So on Sundays, I would pin my badge on and ride all over town. I got a joy out of getting on the bus riding without having to pay. And then finally, I got friendly with a young man who was a minister's son. Got to running around with him, and finally he got me a job working in a grocery store. Why did I have to get up in the morning and harness the horse and drive the grocery wagon back to the store? And then as the orders came in, that I'd have to deliver these orders to different places. I kept this job until the merchant who operated this store passed, and then the war broke out. and they're building ships down in Mobile, and somebody was talking about they had been down in Mobile and how much money they made, and the ship company was still hiring men. So I went down to Mobile. This company, the name was the Chickasaw Shipbuilding and Company. And I was hired. There I worked until they started laying off men. But during that time, I came home, went down to see my father and the rest of the family, and came back, went back to Mobile. There I worked until they started cutting off men because of lack of work. But during that time, they built ships. And if my memory is correct, I think they were named Montgomery City, or the City of Montgomery, the City of Tuscaloosa, City of Birmingham, City of Mobile, City of Selma, maybe some others. I think there's a dozen of them, more of them. But I made more money there in a day than I made in a whole week working at the grocery store. And after this work ran out, I came back to Montgomery, and I didn't find any work, and I went to Birmingham, and a friend of mine carried me to a coal mining company. And when I got there and saw some of the men was going down in the ground to work, I asked the man, didn't he have any work on top? And finally he gave me a job is hauling coal, the fire engine. And I was very glad of that because it wasn't any way in the world that I would went down in the ground to work. But this job didn't last too long. And then I came back to Birmingham. There, I stayed around there for a while. I couldn't find any work and I came back to Montgomery. And this was right in the Depression, like. And I finally landed a job in another grocery store. And I worked there for $1 a day. And I was cut off of that job, and I got a job at a packing house. And this was a very good job, it paid pretty well at that time. And I really enjoyed it, the work. But I lost that job trying to protect a young boy whose father sold peanuts and he was blind. And some white boy who worked there had a dead rat, a large dead rat, and he attempted to throw him on this boy. And I defended this boy to an extent that we almost came to blows. Of course, I was fired because I was one of these empty kind of Negroes that the Euler said, when you had the courage to stand up and fight. But I wouldn't give up. I came back, I came out, I got my money and left. Finally, I opened up a little store of my own. And of course, it wasn't long before I was broke, went out of business. I walked the streets for a while. Then a young man by the name of Robert Williams, who I had met some time previous. I was talking to him about a job, and he said, man, it's a job open down at the baggage room. He said, you come on, go with me down there, and I'll get you on. And he carried me down there, and the man hired me, and that was January 1923. And I worked there for about 3 years, and finally the Pullman Company was beginning to get in its bloom and needed some porters, because Montgomery was expanding. The Pullman agent passed me, whose office was right around at 2-3 doors down while we were working. He said, how would you like to work on a Pullman car? Well, I'd been noticing Pullman porters coming by there, getting off the train with the white jackets on, black pants and shoes shine. I had been admiring one of those jobs ever since I'd been down the railroad. And when this man approached me like that, I told him I'd like it very well. He said, well, if you can get after a leap from the job you have, and I'll send you up to Atlanta for instruction. If you pass the examination, you can come back and go to work. And you still got a few days if you get a 30 days absent relief. And then at the end of the 30 days, if you don't like it, you can quit. So I took him up. Several other of us took that job. We went to Atlanta, were trained. And we came back to Montgomery, and the seven of us, and I made the first trip out. And I went from Montgomery to St. Louis, and the train due into St. Louis at 7 o'clock in the morning, and got there at 3 o'clock in the evening. And I was supposed to come out and start receiving passengers at 7 o'clock. It took me from 3 o'clock that evening to 7 o'clock that night. Try to make the car down. I didn't know nothing too much about it, no how. So I came on back and had to go all the way to Jacksonville, Florida, from St. Louis to Jacksonville, pass through Montgomery. And I was tempting to get off and forget about that job when I got to Montgomery, but I went on to Jacksonville, came back in, I was gone 4 days and four nights. And when I got back to Montgomery that morning, I was so tired I couldn't hardly walk. And I came home and took my bath, got in the bed, and went to sleep. Woke up and I decided then, I said, I believe I'll just hold on to this old job a little while longer until I catch my mule. And I think that after that, I'm gonna let it go. But the thing that made me make up my mind that I was gonna hold on it a while until I catch my mule was the time and every time I'd run my hand in my pocket and could feel that change dang around there that I picked up all around on the loop in them 4 days, till it convinced me that I wasn't ever gonna be able to find anything any better. And I don't mind telling you that day that I was hired to the Pullman Company, until I quit, it took me 41 years to catch my mule. And at that time, I was in reaching retirement age. But during them 41 years, I had my bitters, my sweets. I had my ups and downs. And I met good peoples and bad peoples. But I was able to hang on. Consequently, now that I'm up in my years above the 70s, and I don't know anything else I could have done, that I could have been prepared to live like I'm living at that time. Speaking about the Pullman Company, you know that it was a job at that time that de-appetized service. For instance, you'd get on a train here, going to St. Louis, or Chicago, or New York. The superintendent would come through the train, open the locker and pull out a mop while the car cleaners put on the car, and the car was already cleaned in. He would tell you that the superintendent in St. Louis or Chicago, whichever place you were going, was not hard to get along with. All you'd have to do is deliver the car to that area like you started out from Montgomery. Said he wasn't particularly concerned about whether you brought the mop back to him, just bring him the handle. That means that you wore that mop, if you wore the mop out mopping it, it was just what they expect you to do. But even though that it was a long trip and the work was hard from time to time, I was able to stick it out. We talking about hard work and long hours. At that time, the Pullman Company was working men on a basis of 240 hours a month, or 11,000 miles. You had to make the 11,000 miles. All right, if you made an excess of 1,000 miles, they would give you an extra dollar if you made a certain number of miles over that 1,000 miles. But they could always figure out that you didn't make but the 1,000 miles. They also could figure out your time. They called it PM time. Didn't care what time you went to work. It was PM time. And then they could take the day from you going to work. And if you come in the morning, they could take the day from you when you come in, because you had the time supposed to start at PM. And if you didn't work until after dinner that day, you still wasn't credit in making a day that day. So they knew the PM time system, and they were able to rob men out of thousands and thousands of hours, year in and year out. Aside from having a Pullman conductor on the train to push you on, you had such men as known as a port instructor. The port instructor was the kind of man that we called Uncle Tom's, is known as Uncle Tom, who would get on the train all dressed up with his nice uniform and cap on. He'd go through the lockers and everything and make up a written report, turn it in, and when you got to the end of the line, you wasn't sure whether you'd come back or not because of this port inspector report. Then the third man they had was known as a service inspector, who would ride one train from one point and get off, catch the next train back. And of course, the train he rode down, he probably would get a chance to ride those men's. But for years we got away with it. They didn't know how it was happening. When he catch the train going the other way, going back, the train would always be clean and in position. So we had a secret code that we'd grab the red book when we meet the next train and hold it out. And the porters on that train was going in the direction where the inspector got off, would get his self in readiness before the inspector got on. And of course, we kept that going for years before we was caught up before the inspector caught up with what we was doing. On the Pullman cars, you got a chance to serve peoples. That is, you greeted them at the train, took the bags in, and seated them, saw that they was comfortable, and when I mean that, to give them a pillow if they wanted one, put their hat bags in, I mean the hats in bags, and then at bedtime you made the beds, put them to bed. And one of the jobs that I hated most about it was shining shoes. And even though that I stayed with the railroad 41 years, I never did learn to shine shoes. Not because it couldn't be learned, but I never did want it, and I never learned nothing I didn't want to learn if I could get around doing it. And so I never did learn to shine shoes. But there are plenty of porters who really learned to shine shoes and shine them well. You also had the privilege to meet people such as movie stars, state senators and representatives, and United States senators, and baseball players, and all that kind of stuff. I remember the first man that I met who was outstanding in the athletic field was Babe Ruth, who autographed a ball and give it to me when he got on the train. And when he got off the train, he gave me a tip of 15 cents. And of course, I thanked him for it. And the thing that really shocked me, he was standing in a crowd of all the folks when he gave me this tip of 15 cents. And this is the word he knew. He said, "Nigga, pull off your hat when a white man give you a tip." And of course, I was down in Florida, and I told him that my cap was part of my uniform. And then the company didn't expect us to pull off a cap to bow to people because they give us a tip. He told me that he would remember me when he ride my train again. And if he did, that I wouldn't get nothing. So, unfortunately, or fortune, whichever way it might be, that I never had the privilege to haul him again. There were other people such as Marian Anderson, Pearl Bailey, William L. Dawson of Chicago, the Mill Brothers. I never will forget that we had the Mill Brothers on the train once, and the train was late. We pulled into Evansville, Indiana, and at that time, it didn't have no air conditioning. The train just had screams in the window, and one of these brothers raised a scream and bought a newspaper from a boy who was peddling newspapers downside the train. I said, "Boy, you know who that was bought that paper?" He said, "No, I don't." I said, "That's one of the Mill Brothers." Even though this boy was white, he wanted to go on the train just to see him. Said he'd heard about the Mill Brothers and heard them sing on the radio, and he just wanted to go on the train to see him. And then finally, after he talked to the conductor told him he could run in there and look at him, but he couldn't stay. And he went in there in the train and looked at the Mill Brothers and said hi and turned around and run out. And it was the happiest day for that youngster I ever seen. He wanted to ride the train, but of course the Mill Brothers was on there. There were other people that I met who were nearby, like Mr. Dawson, who was conductor of music at Tuskegee, Dr. Patterson, who was president of the Tuskegee Institute, Dr. Dibble, John Allen Hospital, Dr. Carver. these men that I met any number of times. And I feel that they were close to the kind of people that Pullman Porter was. How Mrs. Methuen was a passenger on my train a number of times. And Mrs. Roosevelt, who I've had chance to make her friendship, and because of her friendship, it led to a USO club in Montgomery. Senator Lister Hill, family, he and his family rode my train in a number of times. Judge Reeves' family were custom riders on my car. Judge Alec Mark, my daughter, had rolled me in a number of times. And there are others that I could mention. And on this job, there were other things that you would come across. For an instance, that we, a friend of mine who ran from Pittsburgh over to Washington on an overnight train, had one passenger rode with him almost every week. And this particular passenger always gave him a dime. And during the Depression, this man who had already bought one home, he mortgaged this home to buy the house adjoining him, this Porter. And the rent then had run down. People wasn't able to pay any rent. And this man who rode with him, gave them the dime every trip, came in this smoking room one morning for a day, and this Porter was sitting there with his head in his hand. He asked the Porter, what is the matter with him? What is the trouble? He told him what he was up against. He said, Porter, what's your address in Pittsburgh? The Porter told him, give him his full name. And he didn't say what he was gonna do. He wrote it down. By the time the Porter got home and took his bath, began to relax, his wife called him, told him there was a man that wanted to see him. So he came down and he told him that this same man, he called his name, that he had been riding with him so long, had sent him over there to talk to him. And they talked about this house and the mortgage on this house. And believe it or not, the man who had been giving this Porter the dime for a number of years was one of the board members of a bank there in Pittsburgh. He told us, sent this lawyer out to talk to him, found out what the Porter owed on this other house, and who held the mortgage. And consequently, it ended up by telling the Porter that Mr. So-and-so says that tell you that he was gonna buy you, have your note bought in, and you pay, make whatever amount that you could pay in reason, then he would match your payment for the next year. And consequently, because of this, this porter was not only able to save the home that he was buying, but save the house that he was living in. I can go on telling you about things about this sort, where pastors have aided porters, have hoped porters to get the children in school in different places. And so you see, the job wasn't always bad. There are some good and some bad in every job. I never shall forget. I was coming down on a train, and we passed through Nashville, Tennessee. We picked up a man, Dr. R.E. Lee, president of the college at Tallahassee, Florida, and his son, who was suffering from a very severe case of TB. By the time we got this young man comfortable, we was going into a little place called Pulaski, Tennessee. When the train stopped there, three or four men came out with a rope, and one of them had a shotgun and the other one had a pistol, and two of the men was barefooted. He said to the conductor, says, "Conductor, we understand that you have a nigger back there in that palace car. We aim to take him off and hang him, teach these niggers a lesson that they can't mix in palace cars with white folks." The conductor, at my surprise, replied, "Yes, I have two colored gentlemen back there in the Pullman car. One of them is very sick. His father is a respectable gentleman, and is president of a college in Tallahassee, Florida." He said, "And they were loaded on my train. They're in my charge. And I don't mind telling you that I'm going to take them to Montgomery alive. Either one of you all attempt to put your foot on my train, I'll shoot you down like I'll shoot a rabbit." And that time the flagman came by in a big hurry, and the conductor stopped him and told him, says, "I want you to go back to the back end of the train. Don't let nobody get on there. But I intend to carry those two colored gentlemen to Montgomery, and I'll shoot anybody who interfere with those passengers." And at that point, this conductor cussed and said, "God damn, don't let me have to shoot you first." We came on into Montgomery, and this conductor, when he got off of the train here, he told the Atlantic Coastline conductor, he said, "Conductor, I got a Negro man and his son back there, and his son is very sick. They're en route to Tallahassee, Florida." He says, "I I'd like to have trouble at Pulaski, Tennessee this morning with him. I'm telling you now so you can be on the alert. I don't know whether you're going to get him to that destination or not, but I brought him to you. Now, I hope you exemplified as much manhood as I did so that nothing will reflect on the railroad. Now, every time the train stopped from Montgomery down to Thomasville, while these people departed the train, I was looking for a crowd to come up to try to take this man out of the car. But it so happened that the first conductor, who was L&N conductor, must put the fear of God in all of them in his action, because we had no more trouble down the road. But if this conductor had been a weakling, those men would have took that sick man off the train and hung him solely because he was trying to get home comfortable. Another incident I remember very well, that we pulled in into the station in Atlanta, Georgia one night. I had a conductor who was known to be the most prejudiced conductor, a Pullman conductor that rode the train. We had a reservation for 8 passengers to be picked up in Atlanta on my car. And when these 8 passengers came down, they were all black. And this conductor said to these passengers that he didn't have any space left, although that I had the beds prepared to receive those passengers at 11 o'clock that night when we got to Atlanta. These passengers walked down side the train to the coach, and after they left, I said to the conductor, I said, you know that you got a space in this car. I said, I was told leaving Montgomery, Alabama, that there would be 8 passengers picked up in Atlanta and I had the beds ready for them. We had 4 lower berths and 4 upper berths. And as soon as you discovered that they were black passengers, you refused them. I'm going up in the coach and I'm going to tell these passengers these beds are available. And I'm going to let the superintendent in Atlanta and the president of the Pullman Company in Chicago know how you are driving business away from them. He told me in no uncertain terms to keep my mouth out of his business. But I went up there and told these soldiers, and when they came back, when I told these soldiers, they carried the sergeant who was in charge told every man to pick up his bag and follow him. He went into the Pullman car, and I showed him the 4 section that was made, and each one of them reclaimed the bed, and the conductor went through the train. Didn't even ask him about the tickets or nothing. He went on up and got the train conductor. The train conductor came back and asked him for the reservation. And this colored sergeant showed him his reservation, showed him his transportation, and of course the train conductor accepted him, and that was another problem. But from then on, every time I caught this particular conductor, there was always something wrong in my car. And then finally, the last run-in I had with him, this same conductor, we was going into Washington one night. They stopped the train in the tunnel, the back end of the train in the tunnel. And the big car was loaded with passengers and had any number of bags. And the red caps were instructed to not to come in the tunnel, only to receive the bag from the edge of the tunnel. Well, I was tired that evening. And when it stopped the train, this conductor came up and told me that I'd have to drag those bags out to the end of the tunnel. I refused, and I told the porter next door to not to unload his, that we were going to fight this out, straighten it out once and for all. Now, this conductor told me he's going to write me up, and I'd never make another trip with him. But as it was that after I wouldn't unload the bags and the passengers was in the car, without the conductor knowing it, I had a friend who was on the dining car, and I asked him to lock the door when he started getting off and washing. So this Pullman conductor attempted to go through the train, and he found the door was locked in the dining car, so he couldn't get through. He came back, he jumped off, over the bags, went up and got the station master. The station master said to me, he said, Porter, are you going to load these passengers? I said, no. These passengers paid a fare to be carried to Washington, brought into Washington. And I don't consider back in this tunnel as part of the path at the end of that destination. And I'm going to ask you, as station master, to pull this train out of the tunnel so these passengers can get off. I said, if you don't do it, all these passengers got a complaint, because I'm not going to unload them in the tunnel. So the station master finally pulled the train up, carried up on the upper level, and we unloaded the passengers. The next morning, the superintendent sent word up to the quarter for me to stop by his office on my way out. And it so happened at that time that we had the organization, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And in our contract, we had a reasonable length of time to make a statement. So the superintendent called me and asked that I come by his office. I went by there and he told me he wanted a statement right then of what happened last night. And of course, I told him that I was sorry that under our contract that I had a certain number of days to make this statement, and I wouldn't make one until I got home. Of course, he threatened to send me back home on the seat if I didn't make a statement, and I told him I would not be intimidated, that he had the privilege to give me a pass back home, or I could go back on the car that I came on. So finally, he gave in with a understanding that I'd make a statement as soon as I got home. But as soon as I got home, that I got in touch with this other porter, who then I told him not to make a statement until he heard from me. And I was representing the local in Montgomery at that time. And of course, I was pretty well up on our contract. But after that, the next trip we went into Washington, they never stopped the train in the tunnel anymore. After my report went into the Brotherhood and the copy went to the Pullman Company in Chicago, we had no further problem with it. Another time that on the Pullman car, we had a man by the name of John Tillman, who was an ex-soldier. And he became very nervous from time to time. He had a nervous breakdown and jumped off the train at Alexander, Virginia, and ran. I wasn't on the train that day. I was the train behind him. And so they put Tillman and locked him up in jail. And they kept him there. And so when I got home, I was told that Tillman was asking for me. And the manager said that I should go up there and bring Tillman back. So I took the train. When I got to Atlanta, I was told that they had Tillman on the train number 37 coming back. And so I went on up to Charlotte, North Carolina, got off and caught this train back. Of course, when I got back in there after they had Tillman, was in leg irons and had him in the upper berth. And the conductor who was on the train with Tillman at the time just laughed and told me that old Tillman flew the coop and ran like a SOB. So I told him, I said, well, Mr. Moore, I said, it may be true that happened to Tillman, but it had also happened to you if the time had come. I said, I wouldn't be so happy about it. Believe it or not, Mr. Moore, before he retired, got sick and had one of these mental conditions. He jumped out of the upstairs floor and ran down the streets in his underwear in a worse condition than John Tillman was. I also recall that attorney Arthur Madison, who rode quite friggin' between Montgomery and New York, and he went up on the train with me one morning, and at that time, even though that a Negro could ride in the drawing room or lower 13, as you might call it, in the Pullman car, he couldn't eat in the diner unless he got behind a curtain. The railroad had two thick, heavy curtains, and they would hang when the Negro would go in there, they'd set them at station 1 and 2, and then they'd pull this curtain behind them so the white passengers couldn't see him sitting back there eating. You talking about crazy laws. Nobody never dreamed of all the things that black people had to go through coming up to this period. Now, it's all right for him, this man, to sleep in the Pullman car back then in the drawing room in lower 13, and white people slept in that same berth behind him that night. It was all right for him to walk through the diner, through the Pullman cars into the diner and sit down in the dining car. But it was against the law for him to eat, but Dr. couldn't be pulled out. So Attorney Madison, being a lawyer, he got mad, snatched the curtain down, and challenged anybody to have him arrested. But he went on through to New York, and nobody bothered him. And consequently, he was so mad he wouldn't eat. And it was discussed from time to time about these things. Of course, you know, when Pullman porters first started out, I don't know what they were making when they started to work way back years ago. But when I started to work, we were making $62.50 a month. And of course, tips were supposed to be part of your salary. And you were driven like prisoners on a farm to make this money. But even though that you're supposed to make this money, there was always something happened that was shorted, and you'd have to pay for it. Maybe a blanket was short, or a pillow was short, or something of that kind on the car, and they checked the car, you'd have to pay for it. There were other problems on the train that during the time that I worked, and especially the beginning of my career with the Pullman Company. Now, any number of times that Negroes came down to the train, would try to get a place to sleep, and were turned down solely because he was black. Many times that there have been just only five or six passengers on a train in the Pullman cars, and two or three Negroes would come down together and would be turned down because of the color. It was state laws in some of the places, and I'm assuming that these laws would have continued to have been on the book had not organizations like the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and the National Association for the Advancement of Colored Peoples had not kept fighting to get these laws off the book. I've known time that I'd go from Montgomery to New York and probably get a chance to get a bite to eat once a day during a wartime. I remember that I left New Orleans one morning and I got to eat that day one time around lunchtime. And then that evening, that night, and the next morning, I wasn't able to get anything to eat. And dining car steward, I would say to reporters who went in that they couldn't feed no porters until all the passion was served. So I got so hungry until I decided I had to do something to get something to eat. So I pulled off my white coat, put on my uniform coat, and met the train conductor, and I bought a ticket for two stations that I figured I'd have a chance to eat between those two stations. And I went in and stood in line till it got to me, and I sat down. When I sat down, the dining car steward would refuse to feed me. By that time, the conductor came by, and he went and told the conductor by it. So I told the conductor, I said, "Yes, conductor." I said, "I bought a ticket." I said, "I'm a passenger on this train, and I expect to be fed like any other passenger." Well, of course, the conductor didn't realize what I was doing when I bought that ticket. And so he told the steward to feed me and told me when I get through eating to bring that ticket back, he'd cancel it. So he went on about his business, and I sat there a long time. The steward was seating everybody else and feeding them. The conductor came back by, and I said to the conductor, I said, "Conductor, I still haven't been fed." So he told the steward, he said, "I told you to feed this man, and I mean for you to feed him, and I'm standing here now until he get his food on the table." He said, "That man is hungry, and I'm going to see that he be fed." So I had already ordered my food. And of course, I was sitting right at the end table with my back to the pantry. And I could hear the dining car waiters and they're talking about it, that I was just stirring up stuff. That won't send the word to me, acting like I was doing, just stirring up stuff. That so often that black people help white people to do what they do to other Negroes. Now, the only person was on my side was this particular train conductor. The dining car waiters, the dining car steward, and all was against him. But finally, my food came out, and I was almost afraid to eat it. I was too hungry to not eat it. But I finally ate it and was able to go on and finish my work. Another time that I went in the diner and ordered dinner between Birmingham and Montgomery. And the steward and all his waiters was gambling on a table. So when I got to Montgomery, I still hadn't had my dinner. And of course, I canceled it. They came running and told me my dinner was ready just as I was coming into the station, so I had to cancel. And my car was cut off of that train and put on another train. And the steward wrote it up and said that I came in there and ordered dinner, and they prepared it and sent for me, and I wouldn't come get it. And of course, the railroad sent a bill into the Pullman Company, and the Pullman Company told me I would have to pay it if I wanted to work. Of course, then I had been on the job so long that I'd hate to lose the job for 75 cents. I went on and paid it. I told them I was paying it in protest, but I paid it.